Yes, hello folks, welcome to the first Manchester United podcast of the season. I'm your host, as always, Phil Brown on Beyond the Pitch. This is the first podcast I've recorded, actually, at all since the week before the end of the season. I think it was Bournemouth. So it's been a couple of months off. It's been nice. I've enjoyed my summer. I had a nice holiday. I hope you all enjoyed your summer. I hope you all had a nice holiday or whatever you've done. And take some time to switch off from football, as difficult as that is these days. I think we're all ready to see United back in action again. It was great to see them against Leeds and, of course, against Lyon. A couple of days ago, I'll be joining United in San Diego in a couple of days, so I'm looking forward to that. I hope you're all well. Thanks to all of you for all your follows on Twitter, as usual, and all your interaction. It's great to be back for the start of the season. I will be doing more of these by myself throughout the season. I hope it's not something that causes you to unsubscribe. I'll also obviously have guests on. I'll have a couple of United Legends players on over the course of the tour. And obviously, Colin will be back, and I'll have guests throughout the season. So stick with me. Lots to get through, of course. We'll talk about United's pre-season. We'll talk about some of the signings that have been made. United just confirmed Onana about an hour ago. I think we've all known that's been an inevitability. We're looking forward to seeing Onana. And of course, they've already sent Mason Mount. And I expect there'll be a few others after United managed to move a few on as well. Some doubt over the Telez deal, to be honest. I haven't asked exactly what's going on with that. So I can't shed any light on it for you. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about a couple of other things. Who could come in, who could go out. We'll talk about how United are doing business differently these days, which I think is something that United fans have been crying out for a long, long time. The decisions that are being made internally about how long to retain players for, you know, what does it take to cost to replace at Manchester United, all the things, football standards now dictating decisions that really should have been done a long time ago. And I think Erik ten Hag's done a magnificent job, I would have to say, in dealing with a lot of the issues that belong to a different era, that belong to the Ed Woodward era. Not entirely his fault, and everyone won't want to hear that, but there's lots of dirty hands in what happened. And part of the reason why United are doing what they're doing today isn't because they've had an enormous change of heart of how they should do business, or it's partly because it's out of necessity. Because they have no other choice. They don't have the resources anymore to go out and squander money without, you know, proper evaluation, without consulting the football department, without making proper decisions that football people are making rather than business people are making. I think that probably the last real commercial signing was Cristiano Ronaldo, ironically. Also, we'll touch on a difficult topic, which is Mason Greenwood. I've been reluctant to talk about that, and I've thought long and hard about this, about how do you talk about it, because it's obviously a very sensitive topic, and there's obviously lots of people that will have different opinions on this, and a lot of that's going to depend on your life experience. There's going to be people that haven't been touched by domestic violence that won't think it's a big issue. There'll be those who have, and who will be traumatized by the idea of Mason Greenwood coming back. And it's something I'm going to try to handle with delicacy and skill, and try to give my opinion on it and what I think United should do next on the issue with Mason Greenwood. So, we'll get to that. And I'll touch on the takeover. Not much to talk about, but I will talk a little bit about it. So, first of all, pre-season. As I mentioned on Twitter, with pre-season, it's not always the best barometer to judge a player's talent, but for a young player, pre-season is absolutely fatal. Because if you're not playing your way into the manager's thoughts in pre-season, when do you do it? And many careers have been launched in pre-season from young players coming in, taking the opportunity to show that they're ready for this first-team experience. Because part of what you're judging when you bring a young player into the first team isn't necessarily ability. Ability gets you to Manchester United. Everyone at United has some level of ability. Anyone that's played football will know how difficult it is. Excuse me. To get to that level, and the level of footballers that don't make it. I mean, I've played with players that were absolutely magnificent, never made it. So to get to a club like United, to get a professional contract, you have to be absolutely exceptional. But what you're really looking at is the things that you can't judge, the intangibles. What's your professionalism like? What's your attitude like? Can you handle the pressure of playing for Manchester United? You know, lots of kids can't deal with that type of pressure, that type of focus. Can you meet expectation? Can you play within the system? How do you play with other players? Are you a leader? Lots of things that you don't find out until you actually play a young player. And there's been lots of examples of young players that haven't had the best talent of a group, but have gone on to make it. I mean, Marcus Rashford is an example of this. Marcus Rashford was obviously considered a very bright talent, but by no means the most outstanding talent at his age group for United. I mean, I've talked to United coaches about this. I remember talking to Frans Hoek about this, who was, of course, part of Van Gaal's coaching team when they gave him his debut. And he had talked to me about this, but, you know, Rashford was obviously a bright talent, but by no means the most outstanding talent that they felt they had at the club. But it's about how you take your chance. And you rarely get more than one chance at United as a young player. You know, you have to take whatever way it comes. You look at young Garnacho. Some players are so good where you don't have to loan them out. And I firmly believe that Garnacho's injury was far more damaging to United than what was ever discussed. I mean, if you looked at Garnacho in that cup final, and I looked at a lot of comments from City fans, and a lot of City fans were like, they were petrified when he came on. He was by far United's best player. I think he will be an immense player for United this season. It's going to be really interesting to see how United fit him into that squad. Play him on the left, which is going to mean, what do you do with Rashford? Do you play him down the middle? If you only sign one striker in Haaland, would you be okay? Because you know you could also play Rashford down the middle. Rashford done quite well down the middle last season whenever United took off Weghorst in games, stuck Rashford down the middle. I remember the Leeds game, when United were 2-0 down that game, brought Rashford in the middle, took Big Weghorst on. Rashford scored right away, played in the second game down the middle and scored. So he can do both. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But really excited to see Garnacho back. And of course, Lisandro Martinez back. It's great to see him back in the team. Obviously, if you look at where United season started to go off for reals, and I think a large way in which you judge the value of a player is how are we without that player? We know what United are like without Rashford. It was a big problem. And of course, we know what we're like without Lisandro Martinez. Goes off in that Sevilla game and everything falls apart. And how players play also is determined by the players they play with. I've often said that I think Jadon Sancho will be a much better winger when United have an out-and-out number 9. If you look at Haaland's first season at Dortmund, Sancho scored more goals and more assists. You'd expect him to get more assists than Haaland, obviously. And then Haaland, the Bundesliga, you can make an argument that, you know, there's some weaker teams in that league there where you should be racking up numbers, but still, you know, I think that he really is in a situation where he has to deliver this season for his career. But you see what happened whenever Maguire was put into centre back with De Gea behind him. Neither of them can play the way Ten Hag wanted to play, which brings a nervousness about them. And I think it was illustrated away to Sevilla. I mean, if you look at that Sevilla tie for me, every single goal United conceded in that tie, home and away, was down to individual mistakes, calamitous mistakes. Away to West Ham, when you needed to take a result, which put United under enormous pressure, De Gea drops a clanger. The game before that, Luke Shaw inexplicably handles in the box, gives a penalty away in the 95th minute. Unbelievable self-harm. But these are things that may not have happened had Lisandro Martinez been playing. We'll never know the counterfactual, but I genuinely believe that's true. And of course, when I know that Ten Hag, the ruthless man that he is, has now moved De Gea on. And when you look at this situation with De Gea, if you really cast your mind back to when Ten Hag took over this football club, if you'd have told me within a year he would have gotten rid of Ronaldo, Maguire, essentially death by a thousand cuts with Maguire. And Ronaldo and Maguire's situation is very similar in the sense that they both had the captaincy and they both played their way out of the team. He gave them the rope, if you like, said, okay, prove to me you're good enough for this football club. Both of those players were brought to a football club that wasn't using football as a metric for determining whether you were going to be rewarded at United or not. Now, Ronaldo was a winner. He didn't need to do that with Ronaldo. But maybe he was an exception because everyone else was playing for a football club that rewarded commercial value, where you could get to stay United for 4 or 5 years beyond your sell-by date for two reasons, if you had commercial value or if it was going to cost more to replace you. This is how you end up with one of the highest wage bills in world football and a squad that's not commensurate with the market value. This is why they're so hard to move on. Ten Hag swung the axe, said the same thing to De Gea. If you'd have said to me a year ago United would be getting rid of Ronaldo, Maguire, De Gea, Fred, McTominay, players like that. No disrespect to the likes of Fred McTominay, who have always given 100%, but they're in a similar situation to Maguire in the sense that they're not good enough to be in a title-winning team or a title-challenging team. And I know a lot of people talk about Maguire and the abuse he gets, of which, let's be honest, is totally unacceptable. But criticism is okay. And being told you're not good enough to play for Manchester United is not abuse. Do you know how many academy kids hear that every single year and have to deal with that harsh reality? Do you know how many kids who play football, who have a dream of wanting to play for United or one of the top clubs in the world, have to face this reality? That's not abuse. And I was a bit of a critic, or not a critic, but a bit confused over the whole statement that Maguire released about losing the captaincy. And I'm agnostic on it. I can understand two sides of the different sides of the points about people saying, well, he wanted to control the narrative. But here's the thing, right? The only way Maguire can rehabilitate his image is by performances on the pitch. One of the worst parts about the demise under Solskjaer and under Rangnick was the constant PR social media statements. You know, we have to take a long, hard look at ourselves. We have to do this, do this, do this. And then they go out next week and put in exactly the same performance. There comes a point where words don't mean much. Maguire's a decent human being. Does not deserve the abuse that he gets. But I felt that by releasing these statements, you drew attention to it. You turned it into a big issue. Whereas if it just had happened on the quiet, didn't need to announce a new captain, didn't need to turn it into a spectacle, and just allowed Bruno Fernandes to take the captain's armband, start the season like that, and just continue with the captain's armband. Nobody would have paid attention, I think. If Maguire stayed at United, let's be honest about this, goes out in the first game of the season against Wolves, has an absolute stinker. United lose 2 or 3. All those people lauding Maguire for his class, maybe not all, but a lot, would be one of the first ones putting the boot into him. How much would that statement mean then? Would it really change people's perspective on him? I don't think so. Sure, it's a bit of clash, no question, because very rarely when established first team players leave the club, is it done on good terms. In fact, that's how it happens most of the time. George Best didn't leave on good terms. No, Mason Mount didn't leave on the best of terms with Chelsea. You know, it happens all the time. You know, you can go through all through United's history, Cantona, Roy Keane. You know, happens all the time. They rarely get to leave under ideal circumstances. Van Nistelrooy, I mean, I just, you know, every time you think of a top player at United, rarely do they get an honoured exit. It's usually acrimonious. And the message has been sent to Harry Maguire. Really, a question that he needs to ask himself is, what does he want? Does he want to play football? And to me, if you're a top player, you don't worry about money because you know you're going to get top money somewhere else. But if you know you're overpaid, it's not analogous to your ability at the current club you're at, then you sit in yours. Some players won't, some players will leave. But if Maguire wants to play for his country, rehabilitate his image, like I said, which I think he could do at another top club that suit plays the way, plays to his strengths, then he has to leave. Because even when he does play, and let's be honest, I think he played 12 games last season and he only conceded one goal. He wasn't a disaster. But this is part of the problem with Maguire, is that he casts such a large shadow. And the PTSD from fans related to when he was poor makes it very difficult for him to emerge from that. And all it takes is one mistake to undo 12 good games. And he looks like a guy that doesn't want to be there. That makes it very difficult to emerge from that reputation. And I think it's very difficult for him at a football club where lots of people have already made their mind up about him to ever recover. I think for him, the best decision would be to move. Clearly, he's not in Ten Hag's plans. But let's be honest about this. He's got nothing to be upset about, because he played his way out of Ten Hag's plans. The fact that any player at Manchester United should expect any different. If you're a top player and you don't play well, you should expect to be moved on. This is true at all top clubs. In fact, this has been lacking at United for so long. You don't get 2-3 seasons at Real Madrid. You know, they re-released Eden Hazard. This is the reality of life at top clubs. You must perform. And a major criticism of United is that they hold on to players way too long. They allow one bad season to turn into two, to turn into three, and then it's impossible to sell them. Because there is no technical director looking at these players saying, this is what we need, based on what? You know, football, short memory. One of the things that Ferguson was really good at was knowing when to sell players. When you would see a subtle demise, not an obvious one. I mean, I remember the summer when he sold in Hughes and Kanchelskis, you know, the fans were turning their head. I was livid. But he saw things in these players that other people didn't. I remember even when he sold Japstam, claimed it was a 100% football decision. I know that wasn't entirely the case. He regretted it. But there's lots of little subtle signs of decline and knowing when to sell that won't be obvious to someone else, because you know these players better than anyone else. Once the decline becomes obvious, then their value diminishes. And that greatly lowers your ability to sell for a decent price. And then what happens is they get hard to move on, because also not just the transfer fee that you're being offered, but the wages that these players are being offered are based on where their form's been at the last 2 years, not where you were when United bought them, when United renewed their contract. I mean, the De Gea situation was a perfect example of that. Why did they need to give him $375,000 a week? Who else was going to do that? You only do something like that if somebody else is lurking in the background saying, we're going to do that if you don't. And then, you know, I understand. No one else was doing that. Ten Hag rightly said, look, we have to decide what it is we are. If we're a football club that wants to move forward, that wants to progress, or are we a business that happens to play football, pick one. If you're a football club that wants to progress, that genuinely judges success by what happens on the pitch, by a win-loss column, not a profit-loss column, then people like David De Gea have to be moved on. And one of the reasons why this is so important is it's not just about the players that you're moving on, it's also about the players that are there. This sends a message to Jadon Sancho, this sends a message to serially underperforming players that there are no more long stays at Old Trafford if your performances aren't up to scratch. And Ten Hag does this in a way where he'll leave you out of the team and force you into a decision. Fred, who wants to play for Brazil, rightly saying, I have to go somewhere and play. How often is he going to play with Mason Mount there? I would imagine it would be less than it was last season. And he's a good player. £20 million player, easily. And he's rightfully asking himself the same question. This is when I need to go. Same with Scott McTominay. Plays for Scotland. He plays very well for Scotland. Lots of clubs would love to get their hands on a player like Scott McTominay. And he would do well at a lot of clubs. This is the time to go. You can't be sitting at United on the bench when you're not in the manager's plans. And of course, I would like to see Fred McTominay moved on, partly because I don't believe they can play in Ten Hag's system in a way that if someone's injured, or, you know, you saw this a lot last season with Casemiro, when Casemiro was injured or suspended, the quality drop-off was enormous. Those squad positions have to be filled by players that are good enough to play for United and that are good enough to play that if a key player gets injured, it's not going to result in a complete collapse. United didn't have that depth last season. There was a couple of key players they couldn't lose and they lost all of them. Casemiro, Martinez and Rashford were three key players they could not lose. They lost all three of them and it had a major effect on how United played. So that depth has to be accomplished. They have to get an answer to that problem. I think Amrabat would be a fantastic centre forward and give them depth, give them quality midfield. He's at the peak of his career. He's physical. He's very, very good technically. If Casemiro had to rest him, get injured, suspended, whatever, I would be comfortable with an Amrabat, Casemiro midfield. You know, Casemiro, of course, as we know, before he came to United, didn't pick up a single red card in Spain. And I think there's two reasons why he was picking him up in England. Obviously, the speed of the game, you know, is very different than what it is in Spain. So you're much more likely to get caught in tackles and what have you. But I think the other thing is, and I go back to what I was saying about De Gea and Maguire, it's partly because who he was playing with, and he was constantly getting exposed. And this is what will happen for me if you play with a Fred or you play with a McTominay. Casemiro was playing with Valverde and Modric and Kroos in Real Madrid. People that protected the ball. People where you weren't constantly getting exposed through turning the ball over. People who were constantly taking up possessions where they were available for a ball where you could have exceptional transitions. When you constantly give the ball away in midfield or in the final third, you put yourself under pressure, then a central defensive midfielder will pick up a lot of bookings because, you know, they're the screen before the defence. When you don't have a central defender behind you that you trust, it makes you nervous. You're constantly thinking about who's running over your shoulder. You're making last-ditch tackles because the person behind you isn't someone that you trust. So I firmly believe that with Mason Mount coming into that team, who can handle the ball, who can play in advanced positions, who can play almost like the Frankie de Jong that he was trying to get from Barcelona, will also make life a lot easier for Casemiro. And of course we have Onana. Look, we all know what's going to happen next season. The first time Onana makes a mistake, there's going to be negative comparisons to David De Gea. Onana can do things De Gea can't, and there's certain strengths that De Gea has that Onana doesn't have. People will deny that, but I disagree. But in this day and age, top coaches see goalkeepers as a central defender who with hands, and you have to be able to play from the back. I mean, I thought when you go back to that Brentford game, it was blatantly obvious then that David De Gea could not play the way Erik ten Hag wanted him to play. That just wasn't in his skill set. And that's okay. You know, one of the problems we've had at United over the years is a mishmash of players that have been bought for different systems by different managers, and then we've tried to fit them all together, and that's not suited to their skill set. So we have to buy players that are suited to the way Erik ten Hag wants to play. And there is nobody more important than a goalkeeper. I don't care if you've got a 40-goal-a-season striker, like Spurs have. If your central defence and goalkeeper isn't right, you aren't winning games of football. Because you'll never outscore a leaky defence. And I didn't rate Hugo Lloris. I thought he had similarities to De Gea to me, always a calamitous mistake. I thought he was one of the most overrated goalkeepers, honestly. So I think, if you look at the top clubs, Alisson, Liverpool, okay, they didn't have a great season last season, but the top clubs in the United Kingdom, they have good goalkeepers. Ederson, you know, Aaron Ramsdale had a really good season for Arsenal last season. So it's really, really important United address that goalkeeping position. Maybe in some sense more important than the striker position, because United don't have a multitude of goalkeepers they can pick from. But they have a multitude of strikers they could pick from. Now, they still need a striker, and I will be amazed. In fact, I'm almost certain they will not go through this window without signing at least one striker. But you build from the back always. One of Ferguson's most important signings is Peter Schmeichel. He signed Schmeichel in 91. And that's when they went on one league titles. And I know Cantona was often seen as the final piece in the jigsaw. And in many ways he was. But without Schmeichel, a lot of those league titles don't happen. So very, very important, you know, to get that situation addressed, which I think they have. And I'm really looking forward to seeing Mason Mount. You know, I didn't watch a lot of Chelsea week in, week out. And so when I would ask the question, what does he do well? Because that was a genuine question. It wasn't a criticism, because I really don't know, because I don't watch enough of Chelsea. I remember when Michael Carrick signed for United, I was often asking the same questions. I remember doing an interview with Martin Yall once. And I said this to him, you know, I said, I tell me something that Michael Carrick does well. And he was flabbergasted at the question. Like, genuinely astonished, and I'm embarrassed they asked it now. And I think Mason Mount's similar in a sense that he's one of these players that if he plays for your team, his qualities are obvious. But he's not making highlight reels every week. You know, he's not scoring, you know, 25 goals a season, you know, all that stuff. So for me, I think he'll do really well at United, and I'm really looking forward to seeing him. And again, like we said, I think United will get the Haaland deal done, which will bring me to another topic, which is Mason Greenwood. There was some rumours when Haaland was linked with United about Atalanta asking for Mason Greenwood, or United offering Mason Greenwood to Atalanta. What I was told was United didn't offer him to Atalanta, but he was discussed on the other end. It wasn't a total known story. And as I said, with Mason Greenwood, it's a very, very, very difficult topic. And I won't do it on social media simply because it's not a nuanced platform and everything's taken out of context. It's not a platform designed for this type of discussion. So, obviously, what we do know about Mason Greenwood, and I want to put a trigger warning on this for anyone who's struggled with domestic violence or experienced it in their life. I have the utmost empathy for you, and I can completely understand why you wouldn't want to see Mason Greenwood in a Manchester United shirt. If it was one of my daughters, I also would feel that way. I'm not saying I feel any different because it's someone else's. What I'm going to say is this. What we do know about Mason Greenwood, what was released, was pretty awful. It was very difficult to have any plausible deniability or excuse for what happened, or to see it in any other way, as Mason behaving pretty abhorrently. And obviously, the GMP have investigated this. United have done their own investigation. So where are we? He wasn't found innocent. That doesn't mean he's not entitled to a presumption of innocence. They're two very different things. In court, if you're not found guilty, you're not pronounced innocent. Okay? You're found not guilty. And a presumption of innocence is different from innocence. It's very important that the judicial system functions this way. Even if, inevitably, people are upset about not getting convictions, I understand. But every judicial system must operate on the premise that guilt must be proven. And I'm not saying that Mason is innocent. I don't know. But I think there was something in the GMP statement that deserved some clarification. And that was new evidence came to light Because all that we've got to see at this point is the evidence against Mason Greenwood, the inculpatory evidence. We never get to see any of the exculpatory evidence. And that's a big statement for the GMP to say, new evidence has come to light. Because I think in the court of public opinion, that deserves to be considered. What exactly is that new evidence? Because maybe, and we have to have humility here, there's something we don't know about this situation that would change the perspective. If Mason Greenwood lost his career over this, he'd be the first athlete in history to do so. Lots of athletes have had transgressions and rehabilitated their image. The other day I was uploading a picture of Mike Tyson. People would have been well within their rights to criticize me and say you're a hypocrite because Mike Tyson is actually a convicted rapist. And it's down to each and every individual themselves to decide what they're okay with and what they're not. I certainly wouldn't try to defend anything that Mike Tyson did. But the question really is with Mason Greenwood, what do we do? United, from a legal standpoint, would find it very difficult to release him because he hasn't been convicted of a crime. They would be legally obligated to pay out his contract, and there could be lawsuits for unfair dismissal and all that. And let's be honest, if he was released, someone else would sign him, and most people wouldn't care. Some people would, inevitably, of course they would. And they're right to care, but legally, United are in a difficult spot. With Mason, I don't believe if he does come back, let's be honest, it's not up to you or me to forgive him because he didn't commit this crime against you or me. It's up to the young lady in question. And right now, them and the police are the only people that really know what happened. So do we completely defenestrate Mason Greenwood and say, not only you're not allowed to play football again, you're not allowed to participate in society again? Or what do we do? I don't know what the right answer is. But my view on this is, I don't think he should lose his career over it. You can be upset at me over for that, and that's okay. I understand it, and if someone wants to tell me why he should, I'm all ears. I will listen to that. Maybe I'm not understanding the problem properly. That's entirely possible. But my view is that if he does come back, it should be a conditional return. It should be something based on donations to women's charities. It should be a commitment. I think Kobe Bryant is an example of how to do this right. Because I genuinely believe that Kobe Bryant believed in what he was doing. He spent an enormous amount of time investing in women's sports. He had his own female basketball academy. He spent an enormous amount of money doing that. So it wasn't just a fiscal donation, it was an emotional commitment. Of course, he idolized his daughters. And they're not entirely the same incident, but I'm just giving an example of someone that, similarities, I suppose. And I think that it is important. I mean, let's be honest, I don't know if I'm quoting the statistic right, but it's close. I think something like 50% of all women that are murdered at the hands of their partner. So let's not diminish how important it is. I know personally people that I love very much that have been victims of domestic violence, and it's distressed me immensely. And I know how hard it is to get a conviction on these charges. So it is a very difficult topic for me to talk about, and I'm not going to do it again, and I'm not going to do it on any other platform. I accept I might be wrong on this. And if I am, I invite anyone to tell me why. And if someone gives me better information than the information that I have, I'm in possession with, I will adjust my position 100%. Because this is not guided by my emotions, by what I want to see. or what is right for Manchester United. This is based on the information that I'm aware of and that I've considered, and the potentials and the probabilities and the possibilities. But again, I have humility on this topic because it's extremely sensitive and difficult, and I may be wrong. And if I'm wrong, I invite anyone to come on here and tell me why, and I will 100% adjust my position if you give me better information. So, that an easy thing to talk about. I won't take questions on it because I'm not going to be led down different alleys on it. I've thought long and hard about how I'm even going to say this. It's very easy to say something that's wrong about this. Say something you regret about this. And this is a topic that deserves a lot of thinking, a lot of care, and a lot of empathy. So that's what I think, anyway. What we will see what happens. Moving on to, of course, potential takeover. We're all frustrated. We're all bored and tears with it. We're all switching off from, you know, mundane updates. And look, it's very simple. It's not a coincidence that the sale has gone a lot like how United transfers go. You know, it's been dragged out. You know, the details, eventually, you know, you just become, it's like quicksand. You know, it just becomes so nauseating and boring and frustrating and infuriating. Part of the reason is because what Manchester United means to you and me is not what Manchester United means to the Glazers. Very, very different thing. And for Manchester United, you and me, we are in love with the football club. We don't have a financial relationship with the club. We don't see it as an asset. We see it as something that we love. So we have competing interests with the Glazers. And the Glazers, of course, have a bottleneck in the sense that they have six siblings. And even they have a different relationship or perspective of what the football club means to them. So there's no consensus amongst those six. And the way it works, the bylaws of the football club works, is that Joel and Avram have 98% control of the football side. But the business side is equitably distributed across all six siblings. So they all have an equal say on what happens on the financial side. And they, nothing can be done without the consent of all six. Four of them, of course, want to sell to the Qataris, and the other two don't. What I'm about to say is not something I agree with, not something I endorse. I'm just telling you that this is what they say. Joel and Avram believe that if they get the other four siblings out of the way, Manchester United can operate properly as a football club. They believe that they are the only two that's committed to United's well-being. That they believe with the right funding, bear in mind they've been trying to get the other four siblings out for pretty much since 2020. Lots of the decisions that take forever to make would be made expediently, such as a signing, such as agreeing to pay an extra 5-10 million here. That has to go through six different approval processes. Some will tell you that's not the case, but I don't see how it couldn't be whenever all six have an equitable say over the business side. And the business side is how much you spend, because it has a direct impact on dividends, profit, things that affect how much the other four get. So I can't imagine they would turn around to Joel and Avram and say, you don't have to have budget discussions with us. Major decisions such as, you know, expenditure don't have to be discussed with us. There's nothing to suggest that's true. So they believe if they could raise the finance to get rid of the other four, United would be run properly as a football club, because there's a consensus amongst Joel and Avram about how United should be run. They claim to love the club. My view on this is, regardless of whether you've got six different opinions, Joel and Avram had plenty of opportunity to prove to United fans that they care about the football club beyond it being a financial asset. They could have shown up for the Munich Memorial. They showed up for the Cup Final. They showed up for both Cup Finals, three Cup Finals. You know, and of course charged United a premium to do so. They weren't flying coach, they weren't even flying first class, were flying chartered jets on United's dime. And refused to speak to supporters, which to me is perhaps one of the biggest insults. No communication over what's going on with this sale. No respect for the football club, for its values, for its culture, for its history, and for the people that make it what it is, its fans. And so they invite the criticism that they get. And when you leave a vacuum of information, it will not be filled charitably by people that don't like them. That's a consequence of not discussion, not sitting down and having respect for people, fans, and discussing things with them. Obviously, there's people inside United that agree with this. They're frustrated too. They're asking the same questions you're asking. They're concerned about the futures. 99% of United employees are not independently wealthy. They're just regular people like you and me. They need their jobs. They need clarity over their futures. It's disrespectful to them. And when United have protests, they're the ones who take it in the neck. It's not the Glazers sitting in Florida. They don't care. It's the regular staff. So you can imagine the animosity that's built inside Old Trafford towards them from regular people. So we're all frustrated with this drawn out process. But the reason why United were put in the market hasn't changed. The reason why United were put in the market was simply because United were no longer a cash cow. And they needed cash to do the basic fundamentals. They needed cash to invest in the stadium, the basic infrastructure. Look, the Glazers see United's value and its brand. How much can they sell United for to sponsors? Not the infrastructure, because that has diminishing returns, right? They don't invest in things that aren't sexy. Players, you can monetize. Players, you can market. Okay, they spend things that are superficial because that's easy to get a return on. Invest in an infrastructure, stadium, the training ground, things that will have no real material impact on the price of United being sold. Because you're not buying the stadium, you're not buying the training ground. If you were, United wouldn't be worth 5 billion, 6 billion. You're buying a brand. You're buying Manchester United. There's lots of clubs that have better stadiums than United, better training grounds. They're not worth a fraction of what United are worth because they don't have the branding. So that's the reason why the Glazers never invested in infrastructure in the stadium, because it doesn't affect the price of the football club. So these reasons still exist. What they can't do is do nothing. I mean, if you look at United's window this season, okay, it's not bad, but it is still slightly parsimonious. I mean, they should be out signing Harry Kane, but they can't financially. I know FFP is an issue, but FFP could be mitigated significantly if the Glazers were to invest money in the football club. Up to 90 million, they could mitigate that. You know, this is, of course, covered by Kieran Maguire. Kieran Maguire talked about this 3-4 weeks ago, and he was talking about United with FFP and clearly illustrated that United could easily go to market and sign Harry Kane or someone of that ilk and still spend circa 150 million and be compliant with the FFP. But a big reason why they're not compliant with the FFP is because of the business model of the football club. So with the Glazers, they still have to address the core issue as to why they went to the market in the first place. Where's the money coming from for the stadium upgrades? You know, one of the things I don't want to see is them rock up, you know, 4 weeks from now. You know what? We found investment. Forget about the last 6 to 8 months. The football club has been in limbo. You know, if you go back to January, United were a title race in January. They're the only football club that qualified for Europe that didn't spend in January. They lost Weghorst, Sabitza. They signed 2 players. The squad, pretty much, in terms of numbers, isn't exactly the position it was in. Some sense worse because some other players have left. You know, De Gea has left. Of course, other players will leave. You know, so the wage bill's been heavily cut with the loss of De Gea and Ronaldo. You know, you're getting other players off the wage bill. I agree with those decisions, but like I said at the start of this podcast, the reason why they're acting as a football club today is because they have to. If you looked at United's previous financials, they were not healthy. Record revenue. But you judge a football club or any business based on its profit. That's revenue. 600 million revenue is meaningless if you're losing, if you're over here at 700 million. So, without an immediate cash cow on the horizon, you know, it's hard to see where that money's coming from. If you're an investor, imagine you go to market with your house. Your house gets appraised at 500 grand. You say to an investor, hey, give me 1.5 million, we'll do this place up. What? We'll do that for when I can buy it for 500 grand. That's all it's worth. Yeah, but we'll get it back in the long run. I think there's better investments out there for our money. You know, investment firms, capital firms, that's pulled cash from other investors who couldn't care less about football. They want a return on that, and they want a return on that within 3 to 5 years. That's typically what they look for. Is United a sound investment? When you look at their competition, you look at Newcastle. Newcastle will keep spending. You look at Arsenal, what Arsenal spent this summer. Liverpool will not have the same season. The things that United need to guarantee a return are not guaranteed Champions League success. Not just qualification, Champions League success. They still have to replace a shirt sponsor. There's a reason why they haven't, because they can't. Because commercially, United, if United were being offered better deals for their shirt sponsor than the one they have, TeamViewer would be gone. But they're not, for a reason. And anyone that tells you that the protests aren't having an impact just aren't being truthful. Make no mistake about it. Those protests, think about it from TeamViewer's perspective or any of these brands' perspective. They're not used to seeing stuff like this. They're not used to having their social media bombarded by thousands upon thousands of people. Nasty messages. And they sponsor sports teams in the US. Never garners that type of reaction. There are very few sports you will get that kind of reaction in. It quickly kills the dopamine rush of doing a deal with a football club or any brand when it results in abuse. And it only takes a couple of individuals to get that abuse. For the pendulum to swing the other way, for them to say, you know what, this isn't worth it. It's very difficult for us to scale value here. Because what are you buying? You're buying fan equity. You're buying the right. You're using United and their fan base. This is what they sell. They say with 660 trillion, zillion, batillion fans. What does that mean? That means 660 million customers, potential customers, that are going to buy your product because you sponsor the football club that they love. But when you have no fan equity, when you can't do that, it makes it very difficult to go to any potential commercial partner and say, let's partner. Wait, that relationship is toxic. Very difficult to do that. And football fans are very, very tribal. So I think, of course, one of the reasons why the Glazers, if the protests weren't having an impact, the Glazers wouldn't be trying to sell to them. They wouldn't be going to Sky TV and saying, you need to edit this out. I mean, this just shows you how stupid they are, that this wouldn't, how they did not know that this wouldn't leak, and this would be the most moral victory that you could give any fan group. That we are so petrified of you, that we're going to confiscate your flags, that we're going to edit out your audio. This is impossible. Impossible to censor with social media. Absolutely impossible. You know, this is so silly. I mean, anyone in a brain would sit down in that room and go, look, if you do something like that, I mean, to borrow a tired phrase, it's rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic, it's pointless. Because what's different today than what was 2010 is when the green and gold protests were happening in 2010, sponsors weren't accessible. Social media, Twitter, what have you, was in its infancy. And not now. Within 5 minutes of United announcing a commercial partnership, what happens? They get bombarded. And they have to announce them. Or what's the point of doing them? So there's no point in doing commercial partnerships with Manchester United or any brand for that matter, and doing it discreetly. Defeats the purpose. So for the Glazers, they have a problem of trying to find consensus among six siblings that want very different outcomes. They may not get these offers again. Next season's success is not a guarantee. You know, they could easily finish it at the top four next season. The mood will change dramatically. So, the Glazers still have to address the core issue as to why they went to the market. They need money. If they didn't need money, if United was still a cash cow for them, they would not have gone to the market. They've resisted that over and over again. But make no mistake about it, in 2010, they came very, very close to defaulting. They did default on a lot of their mortgages on strip malls in the US, and they refinanced in March. Hicks and Gillette missed that refinancing window and did go bankrupt. The Glazers almost did that with United. So that'll be in the back of their head. Do we really want to risk this again? Will we ever get a Sheikh Jassim at the table again? Will we ever get a Jim Ratcliffe at the table again? And people, if they ever put this football club up for sale, will be really, really mindful of being played. You know, none of this is good for their brand. I guarantee you, we are not happy about any of this. They will have wanted a relatively quick sale. But the reality is, what they're asking is far too much. And this just speaks to the avarice, of course. It speaks to human beings that see no value in anything but profit. Arid human beings. And when you look at their father litigated against their own family, took them to court over an inheritance, until there was nothing left. So internal family squabbles over money is nothing new to these people. We'll have to see how this thing ends, but hopefully we get a resolution to this soon. I think they're playing a really risky game, because if we're still in this situation come the start of the season, they're one or two bad results away from complete anarchy. And then the balance of power shifts to the buyers, not the sellers. And all of a sudden, Sheikh Jassim and Jim Ratcliffe will not feel the same sense of pressure to keep up in bids when the Glazers are dealing with mutiny inside the stadium every week. You know, Ten Hag's not going to want that. Players are not going to want that. They're playing a very risky game. And you look at the start of the United season, they've Spurs away, they've Arsenal away. So it's a really risky dice with them. They're rolling. We will see what happens. Anyway, folks, this is the first podcast this season. I'm going to run. Thanks to all of you for all your downloads, likes, retweets, your messages, everything else. If you direct message me, just to let you know, I've said this before in the podcast, there's a very slim possibility of actually ever getting me, because they're just littered with spam from people all over the world asking me what's going on with United transfers, and I give up trying to check them. So most of the time I don't see them, so my apologies, I'm not being rude, I just do not see them. But anyway, I hope your mental health is well, your physical health is well, and once again, I really hope some of the more difficult parts of this podcast land well with individuals and realize I'm trying to do this honestly, and if I'm wrong, let me know. I'll accept that. All right, folks, take it easy.